The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so to this week, May Lynn Yap is a graduate of the Trinity Centre for People with Intellectual Disabilities. She joined me in studio alongside Ambassador for the Centre, Hugo MacNeil, to talk about the importance of accessibility and inclusion when it comes to education and the workplace. Hallie Rubenhold spoke to me about her new book, The Five, which looks beyond the myth of London's infamous serial killer, Jack the Ripper, to focus on the lives of the five women who became his victims. Mother and son, Joanne and Daniel, told me about the difference a simple act of kindness made to their lives when they needed it most. And Dancing with the Stars judge Brian Redmond talked to me ahead of a switch-up week that will make history. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy it. The college experience is one that should be accessible for everyone, and no one knows this better than my two guests this morning. We have May Lynn Yap with us today. We have Hugo MacNeil with us today, both with special connections to the Trinity Centre for People with Intellectual Disabilities. I'm going to begin, if I may, you're both welcome, but I'm going to begin with you, May Lynn, and to tell us all about yourself, please. How old are you? Where are you from? What are you doing here today? Well, that's a lot of questions, so take them one at a time.
Okay, so I'm 31 years old. I live at home with my mother, Anya, and my dog, Murphy, who I love so much.
Sure.
I work in CPL Recruitment Agency.
Yes.
And I absolutely love it.
You've been there for a while now, have you?
I've been there nearly 3 years now.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about your connection with people with intellectual disabilities.
Well, I know a lot of people with Down syndrome. Over the years, I've been involved with Special Olympics clubs at the age of 14, thereabouts.
And you participated in the
I do.
Special
I'm
Olympics.
A swimmer.
You're a swimmer,
I'm
great.
A swimmer. I'm a national and world athlete.
Multi-medal winning, I hope.
Yeah, I do my best.
Yeah, okay. So you went to, did you go to regular school as well or did
I
you?
I did. Okay. I went to mainstream school. I went to mainstream primary and secondary and then went on to third level education. And one of them is Trinity College.
Okay. And how did you find the mainstream school system?
Hard going.
When was it at its toughest for you?
I think the toughest was when I wasn't getting enough supports. I had some supports in secondary school in my third year.
Yeah.
When I was doing my junior cert. I had lots of support for that.
Did you find people accepting of you, May Lynn, or did you find that people had trouble mixing it up a bit?
I found it interesting. I love school. I really did. Okay. I felt like it was home.
Well, that's a good thing.
I loved it.
And what about then when you want to leave school and with intellectual disabilities, you still have ambition, you still have dreams.
Yeah.
What did you have dreams of?
Oh, God.
That's a big question. I'm sorry for putting this to you, but I actually want to know because you obviously had them.
Well, at the age of 14, I always knew what I wanted to do as a career, and that is to public speak. I think the first time that I spoke was in Mountjoy and Weefield Prison at the time. I was asked by Special Olympics if I wanted to speak.
Yes, and you
about
did.
About my journey. And I did. I went in and in front of all the different prisoners and... It was quite an experience, I must say.
Were you nervous doing that or did you love it? But were you also excited at the same time?
I was excited, but also very, very nervous. Yeah.
You went to Trinity College, is that right?
Yes,
in 2008.
I did.
Tell me about your experience in Trinity.
I think when I came out of doing the course, I succeeded socially. So I got involved in loads of different societies and one of them was the Trampoline Club.
The Trampoline Club.
Yeah.
It has its ups and downs.
It has.
Sorry. Go on. Tell me tell me about why you joined that club and what attracted you to it.
The students.
Okay. They're a nice crowd.
It was a nice crowd.
Sure.
Interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
Because the mainstream students.
Yeah.
I did feel like a little bit of an outsider.
Okay.
In certain situations. Because I did not know anyone at all going to these sessions.
So how do you break down those walls then?
I just went in, just did it.
That takes some confidence.
It did. It,
by the way, regardless of where you're coming from in life and society, it takes confidence to break through any class of walls. So this isn't saying, aren't you great? It's saying, isn't it difficult for one and all?
I find it very difficult socially sometimes. It's the whole acceptance, I think, of people with disabilities.
Why do you think people who don't have an intellectual disability find it so hard to just mix it up with people who do have one? Do you think it might be fear?
Yeah, I think it's fear. I think it's the fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
Or a lot of people that I know of are not really allowed to make arrangements in terms of being involved in certain societies in Trinity, because they go out, you know, in the evenings, going for drinks in the pub or whichever. You
socializing,
know?
Few pints, whatever. Did you do all of that?
Yes,
you did.
I did.
Why are you
I
smiling like that? What do you are you do you feel guilty that you did this?
I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
I actually went onto Facebook initially, and I wanted to have the feeling of inclusion.
Okay.
And acceptance by them.
Sure.
So I saw it was around Christmas time, and I saw they were doing 12 pubs at Christmas.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
So I decided that the time was right. I just plucked up the courage and I said, you know what, I'm going to go. Even though I was a bit hesitant at first.
Yeah.
And I had a plan.
Which was what?
Which was, I'll go in on the bus,
yeah.
I'll have my water in my handbag just as a backup and not drinking too much. I went, I enjoyed it and I left at a certain time to be on the bus by 11:30. And
good
that
thinking.
Was my plan.
Good
and And I went and I did that.
How many pubs did you get through?
Probably five.
Five. Did you have a drink in every one?
Honestly, no.
No.
I had my water as well. So I wasn't really drinking much. So I was very cautious of everyone drinking around me. Made me feel, no, I'm not going to have
just
a drink.
Careful.
Just in case if something happens.
Okay, no messiness and just mind yourself.
Yeah.
Were you glad you did it looking back?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was exciting at the time.
When you left the workplace, and I'm conscious Hugo's here and I want to bring Hugo in just a moment, but just because we're on a roll here.
Okay.
Yeah. I want to ask you, when you left college, you said public speaking was your dream.
Yeah.
So what job did you get and was it difficult to find work?
Yes.
It was difficult to find work.
I found it very difficult to find work.
What was the most common response from people, from employers to you when you said, I'd like to work for you? What did you find the most common response was?
The common response was, I'll keep you on file. I'll keep you in mind.
Did you get a lot of that?
There was a lot of that, yeah. I think it's mostly the fear of rejection from employers. But I'm lucky to be in the situation that I'm in now, which is working for CPA Recruitment.
Which brings us beautifully onto Hugo McNeil. Good morning, Hugo. People, morning. Of course, will know you for many different reasons, but obviously we cheered you on the rugby pitch back in the 80s. Since then, you've gone on to do many, many things, but you're also an ambassador now for the Trinity Centre for People with Intellectual Disabilities. Tell us about how you and May Lynn are sitting side by side here this morning, the connection and the importance of that connection, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And I got involved in the centre by going to a breakfast one morning in Chartered Accountants Ireland and seeing some of My Lynn's colleagues talking about how their life had been transformed by the course. I heard their families saying how the lives of the families were being transformed by somebody going to college, having somewhere to go afterwards. And I heard the employers saying what a great reaction they'd been. So I got involved and got to know My Lynn and a number of the other students because up to now a tiny percentage and still remains a tiny percentage of people with intellectual disabilities go on to college. In 2017, when the last survey was done, there were 84 people with intellectual disabilities out of a total population of 57,000 who were in third level education.
That's a shocking figure.
It's a shocking figure. And it wasn't that they were never deliberately excluded, it was never included. And what you kind of seen with My Lynn and many of her friends and colleagues is the transformational impact that going to college and then having the job afterwards brings. And with the model that's been built up in Trinity with the two-year course in science, disability rights, arts, science and inclusive applied practice gives a great grounding. And so big thing is the transformational nature this has on families. And we've gone from 4 business partners to 30 business partners who are taking our students, including CPL and many other great firms. Yeah. And the feedback from them is fantastic.
The great thing about this story is everyone's winning. It's really, society wins, the companies win, the people who work in the companies, you win, the family win.
You have put your absolute finger on it, right? And it just dawned on me a couple of months ago, because when you first get involved, you don't want to be overly sort of prescriptive. Yeah. A lot of people have been doing it for many years. So I kept introducing them to companies, having this sort of success like my sure. Lynn has. And then we kind of said, we've gone to the 30 companies. You know, we need to spread it around the country much yeah. more, because the Trinity Centre is, there's 9 other centres who do this to a lesser degree. But the great challenge now and the opportunity is to take it right around the country to places, because we're only scratching the surface yeah. here. I'd love if every company, you know, in Ireland considered whether we could take someone on with intellectual disabilities. Now, they won't all, but there is now, having seen the extraordinary benefits it has. One of our students, Margaret Turley, a friend, says, I love being able to grumble about paying taxes. And so, you know, it's not only the right thing to do, we would say on this, but it's actually a great return on investment.
And that's what I mean by everyone's winning from a thing. Why do you think, Maylin, that you are so happy in the workplace and getting on with your life?
I think it's more about everything that I dreamed of doing, I am doing. I work for a great company who are very supportive of me.
Yeah.
They encourage me and they challenge me in the work that I do, which is fantastic for me. They keep me engaged.
Yeah.
I love that they include me in a lot of things. Like, for example, going out for a drink with them, to being involved in events, to organising events with them.
It's so important that idea of inclusion, that word, can get a bit lost as an abstract term.
Absolutely.
But actually think about including someone.
Yeah.
And that decency and correct attitude should trickle down to then children doing the same thing in schools.
Yeah.
Including, are you going out to the shops? Yeah, do you want to come? Yeah, of course I want to come. Mm. I want to be included. Mm. So that's the message here.
It's fantastic. A couple of, when Marlene's students were recently leaving their companies, 15 or 20 people came to actually cheer them on at their sort of final presentations.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely brilliant. And poets often sum up this best. And Brendan Kennelly, the great Kerry poet, who looked at the work of the centre, and he said, disability is a mask that conceals a rich, surprising and fertile ability. And he said, what the TCPID does is removes the mask and reveals the beauty and promise of a hitherto hidden talent now brought into the light of day. And there's no better example of all the many students that we've had coming through the centre and being great ambassadors for us than Maylin in that regard.
You're blessed. You're blessed. And we were very blessed to have you come in to see us this morning. Thank you for coming to say hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's been great to see you. You wanted to be a public speaker and your dream came true, because you're a wonderful public speaker, if you don't mind me saying so.
Thank you.
Maylin Yap joining us this morning. Hugo McNeil, continued success with the programme.
And thanks very much.
To brighter days ahead.
Absolutely. We're only scratching the surface. And Ireland is leading, you know, this way in internationally. And
great.
We want to take it right around the country.
What a good news story. Thank you both for coming in to see us this morning. We leave it there for now. The text number 51551. I've been talking about a book recently called The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. And one of the reasons I loved this book so much was that rather than talk about Jack the Ripper, the almost pantomime villain we've been hearing about down through the years, this book focuses on the 5 women he killed, some of whom have an Irish angle, but all of whom have a story that has been so well told by Hallie Rubenhold that we said, please come and talk to us, as she has done this morning. Hallie, good morning and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Good morning.
Why did you decide, enough with Jack the Ripper already, let's talk about the 5 women?
Oh, precisely for that reason. Because Jack the Ripper, I mean, literally forests have been felled in the process of telling his story. There are libraries dedicated to telling the story of Jack the Ripper. And the narrative of Jack the Ripper always starts with the death of the victims. And these women have been reduced just to clues in a big whodunit. And it seemed absurd to me that there had been no full-length biography written about these women ever.
Right, well, let's talk about why that might be. I mean, one of the reasons is because I suppose if you're to go to primary source material trying to find anything out about them, was it hard to put that together? Because I get the sense that sometimes you had an enormous jigsaw puzzle, maybe 1,000 pieces, but only 880 pieces available to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is it. But it's like, you know, if you think about an archaeologist who is doing a dig somewhere in an ancient site somewhere in Greece, you know, and they pull an urn out of, or bits and pieces of an urn out of a site, you know, and you may have a handle and you may have a base and you may have bits. But then you can kind of put it together because you know what others just like it that have been pulled out of the earth in a better condition look like. And that's kind of what writing this book has been like. So, yes, we don't have diaries and memoirs that have been left by these women. But what we do have are bits and pieces that can tell us where they were at certain times of their lives. And we can layer that over with the experiences of other people who were there at that time who experienced the same thing. So we'll have an idea, for example, we might not have the voice of Catherine Eddowes at Great Yarmouth Workhouse in the 1860s, but we do have the voices of other people who were there at that time having that same experience, giving birth to a child.
So you can piece it together almost asymmetrically.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's fair to say, for example, you know, if you look at, you know, the censuses, and the censuses are marvelous ways of you know, really accessing, you know, a snapshot of life at a particular place for a particular family at a particular time. You know, if you look at that, and that is, you know, it's got rich information in it. It's not only telling you who these people were, you know, who lived in a house, what they did, how old they were, where they were born, you know, even if they had disabilities, you know, all sorts of things. It tells you who their neighbours were and what they did. It gives you a sense of what the area looked like, what the house looked like. And you know, from that you can create a much bigger picture. And you can even think about it today. You know, if we were to take, you know, a little bit of information about you, about where you are at any given time, and then study the whole environment around you, we can get a pretty accurate picture of where you were and what you were doing at that time.
So tell me this, why for 130 years until, actually I'm not going to lie to you, until I read your book, why did I always think Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes, sex workers?
Because everyone did. Everyone did.
Yeah.
That's part of the mythology. That's, you know, honestly, if you vox pop anybody on the street and you ask them, you know, like, tell me one thing about Jack the Ripper, and what they'll say is Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes. And that's the one thing that is actually categorically wrong. It's categorically wrong.
But did you go into the book knowing that, or did you go into the book discovering that?
I went into the book totally discovering that.
Really?
In fact, I set out to write a book about 19th century sex work. Seriously.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is one of the things that annoys me so much, because my detractors, and I'm sure we'll get on to who they are, have been saying, oh, well, she came to this with an agenda. She's got a very clear, you know, feminist agenda, and she wanted to change these women so they weren't sex workers, and, you know, they seemed much more redeemable. Well, no, that wasn't the case at all. In fact, I set out to write a book about Victorian sex work. And I thought, well, who are the most famous sex workers in the 19th century? Oh, well, that'll be the, you know, victims of Jack the Ripper. And lo and behold, when I look at the evidence, and what we call evidence, you know, it just wasn't there. It just wasn't there, with the exception of Mary Jane Kelly, who is the last victim, who left a very clear trail of evidence that she was engaged in the sex trade, and also Elizabeth Stride, who also left documents that attest to the fact that when she lived in Sweden, she was involved in prostitution, and also again for a short time she appears in the police records in London as well as a woman soliciting on the street.
Yeah, I love what you do in the book, where you each chapter is a victim's name. It's quite stark and definitive, and you know what you're getting, rather than conflating all the stories. So I think that gives it a certain clarity. And yet there is a strain of connectivity between them all. There's alcoholism, there's domestic abuse, there's homelessness, there's sorrow. There's a terrible sort of sadness to it all, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think writing the book, I mean, it took me to a very dark place, as you can imagine. And it was there were times when I had to walk away from it for various reasons. You know, I got very angry at times. I got very depressed.
About what?
About how these women's lives, you know, that was no safety net. The safety nets that were there were punitive, you know, like the workhouses, there wasn't a way for them to get out of where they were because society was structured in such a way that poor women didn't have opportunities, or they were very, very limited. So if you took a false step, you know, that was it. You fell all the way to the bottom.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about homelessness and homeless figures in this country a lot. I'm not sure if it's the same in the UK, but when you talked about, you know, 70,000 people roaming London with nowhere to sleep at night. But by the time Jack the Ripper is stalking the streets in 1888, you're looking at up to 600 people in Trafalgar Square alone. What an image.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's incredible. And that doesn't even take into account, you know, how many people were sleeping rough in Hyde Park, on the embankment, and also in all the little corners all over London, you know, in the little alleyways and the doorways, all over.
Why do you think, just to return briefly to the idea of being labelled prostitutes or sex workers, why did that story persist for the Five?
Because it suited the narrative, because it was about, I mean, you know, and it's still about, I hate to say it, bad women deserve to be punished, you know, and if you contravene the feminine norm, so if you are, in the 19th century at least, you know, if you are not doing what a woman is supposed to be doing, and a woman, there is, you know, basically a very, very defined role for a woman, and that is a woman is a mother, a woman is a wife, a woman is a daughter, a woman is a caretaker. She has a place in another man's home. And if she is not living her life to that outline, then there is something wrong with her. She is defective. She is broken. She is an immoral woman. And the Victorians conflated the idea of the broken woman, so the woman who for whom life has gone catastrophically wrong, whether that's through addiction issues, whether that's because she's you know, split up with her husband's died, something's happened. And the fallen woman, who is a woman who was sexually compromised, the Victorian mind conflated those two because, you know, that woman is morally defective, and that applies to every aspect of her character. She's a bad woman.
And the five women we're talking about, Mary Ann, Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Catherine Eddowes, Elizabeth Stride and Mary Jane Kelly, brutally murdered in the year 1888 in just 9 weeks. It's a horrible scenario, to say the least. But with the five people, there's I know that there's Irishness in some of them. They have of Irish extraction, which wouldn't be uncommon for all the people who left this country to live in the UK. What about their stories, Hallie, did you find most startling or revealing?
Oh, gosh, basically everything I thought I knew about them was wrong. First of all, you know, as you allude to, you point out that this is a much bigger story than just an East End London story.
Yeah.
The East End was where they were killed. This is not an East End story. The story of their lives, first of all, it's pan-London, but it's also, it stretches into other corners. It's Wales, it's Ireland, it's Sweden, it's other parts of the UK, it's Windsor, it's Wolverhampton. These people had a range of experiences. They were the poor working classes, but their lives were not as we imagined them necessarily to have been. And each five of these women had a very distinct and different experience in life. For example, you know, kind of Annie Chapman. I didn't know that Annie Chapman's family had kind of moved up into the lower middle classes. Mm. And her father had been a trooper in the Second Life Guard, very prestigious regiment. She had married... Well, then he became a gentleman's valet, and then she had married a gentleman's coachman, and she had lived on a country estate just right near Windsor Castle. You know, that was surprising. Elizabeth Stride came from Sweden. She was a Swedish immigrant. You know, that was incredibly surprising. It was surprising to me that these women, four of the five women, were killed in their 40s. They were not young women. And even Mary Jane Kelly was about 25 when she was killed. You know, we have this Hollywoodized notion of what these women were like, what they look like, you know, this sort of young, sexy things in low-cut bodices wearing rouge, sauntering under gas lights. And, you know, this wasn't the reality at all. This was not who these women were.
Briefly then, on, I suppose, on Jack the Ripper, Hallie, as... a phenomenon, forgive the word, but I couldn't think of anything better right now. But do you feel that he has been in some ways glamorized or has he been treated peculiarly by time and history?
Oh, he's been totally glamorized. You know, I mean, it's absurd how glamorized he's become. But not only has he become glamorized, I mean, his victims are, you know, it's hard for people to even conceive that the victims were real people. And, you know, we joke about this. In London, you know, people come to this city from all over the world. From all over the world, they come to the East End to go on these Jack the Ripper tours. And I, you know, I realized at some point, this is like, these five women are being killed over and over again every single day. Every single day, somebody is standing on the streets multiple times a day describing how these women's bodies were ripped open, how their organs were ripped out, and with very, very little context and very little feeling for, you know, the fact that these were real people. And so what they talk about is, oh, Jack the Ripper, he's so clever and nobody caught him, and you know, the way he killed and the skill. You know, there are businesses named after Jack the Ripper. There is a Jack the Clipper barber shop. Mm. There is a Jack the Chipper fish and chippy shop. There's Jack the Ripper merchandise. There's Jack the Ripper video games. You know, there's Jack the Ripper this and Jack the Ripper that. And Jack the Ripper cushions and pencils and, you know, crikey.
Yeah.
Really? You know?
Who are the Ripperologists, Hallie?
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
I've never heard of them.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I mean, it's the funny thing is often when I say the word Ripperologist to people who've never heard of Ripperologists, the first thing that happens is people start laughing. Oh, my God, there are Ripperologists. Ripperologists are people who have, for the most part, dedicated their lives when they're not at work or doing other things to trying to figure out who Jack the Ripper was or, you know, really kind of immersing themselves in that world and studying that world in great detail. And they don't like me very much.
And what would their chief point of irritation be when it comes to you?
Oh, everything.
Why do you annoy them so much?
Well, the reality is, okay, so when they found out that this book was coming out, they started trolling me 8 months before the book came out. Okay.
Okay, they're hardcore.
8 months before the
hardcore
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And what they didn't like in the first instance, what they objected to was the blurb on the book cover that was, you know, saying that this is, you know, the first full-length biography of the women who were killed by Jack the Ripper. And you know, that there isn't another book that deals with all five of them together that is a full-length book that explores their lives. And so they started saying, well, you're a liar, and then they basically didn't like what I was saying, and they were saying that, you know, I was lying about things, that I was hiding the truth, that I was ignoring evidence, that I was redacting documents.
I didn't realize people were so proprietorial, or that there was a group that could be so proprietorial.
Yeah, proprietorial is the word. It's there's a sense of ownership over these victims and their stories. And they feel, you know, it's almost cult-like, nephrology. It's like they feel they are the keepers of the flame. They know the truth. Only they know the truth because they've been reading the same documents for 20 years.
Over and over again.
It's absolutely absurd. Mm. It's absurd. And you would think that they would have welcomed this. There have also been criticisms that, I came at this with, dare I say, a feminist agenda. You know, God forbid, a feminist agenda. You know, that I wanted to restore these victims to respectability. So by doing, you know, I had to sweep under the carpet the fact that they actually were prostitutes, which is completely untrue. There just isn't the evidence there to suggest that they were. It just doesn't exist.
Right. And as a man who simply loves history, I thought it was an utterly engaging, absorbing story. I wasn't seeking out hashtags or agendas anywhere. You'd be glad to know. I just thought it was a bloody good read. and of course, there's talk of a television adaptation, which would make sense, because most film and television adaptations of the Ripper story are, as you previously described, in other words, kind of cliched.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we are working on developing this right now with the BBC. But, you know, who knows with television, you know, things, there are lots of hurdles to jump before it actually comes to pass. So who knows what will happen, but I would absolutely love to see it on the screen.
I loved your book so much that I'm going to ask you about your next project. Have you got one on the
Sure.
go? And can you tell us a bit about it?
I'm actually going to stay in true crime.
Good.
And I am. My next book is about the Crippen murder of 1910.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and you know what? There's a very strong Irish element in that, because one of the things I'm looking at is Dr. Crippen's first wife. Well, he killed his second wife, Belle Elmore. Dr. Crippen was an American. His wife was an American. He was a quack doctor. She was a music hall performer. And they moved to London, and he killed Belle Elmore and ran off with his secretary and tried to escape to Canada. And he was caught and brought back, and he was put on trial and executed. I'm going to look at the women's lives, but I'm going to look at a lot of aspects of this story that really isn't examined, and also our interest in true crime. But one of the things I'm going to look at is his first wife, Charlotte Bell, was from County Leash. She was an Irish immigrant to America, and she became a nurse, and her whole family went to New York. And so I'm going to be looking at her family
amazing,
as well.
Amazing. And who needs fiction when you have such a wealth of story in the past? But we were only talking yesterday to a lady who'd been to the public library in New York and found all these documents of famine emigrants who'd joined a bank, and the detail you can get from the documents show you.
Oh,
that,
it's amazing!
Yeah, so you're talking about Mrs. Bell from Leash in Ireland. I mean, in the early 20th century, that's only a generation and a bit ago, two generations. So you know, it's very much living history in some ways.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And what I actually really hope to do is to be able to track down some descendants of Charlotte Bell's family, if they are still
easy.
In Ireland.
Easy, that's an easy one. Listening to this program, they'll be on. We'll pass on the details. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and maybe when the Crippen book is out, come and see us, and we'll talk again. But thank you so much for your time.
To.
Yeah, I enjoyed our chat today.
You're
thank
very
you.
Welcome.
Hallie Reubenhold joining us there with The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper. I spoke about it quite a bit last summer. It's one of my favourite history books of the last 12 months. And there's a beautiful hardback version of it, which I have, and it's widely available still. But the paperback is not long out, so well worth a purchase. You'll enjoy that no end. The text number this morning, 51551. Joanne, a very good morning to you.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
It's very, very good to talk to you. We were chatting last week about all sorts of things, and something caught your attention. What was it?
Absolutely. My son, Daniel, he began acting there about 3 years ago. And it was just the good people. I suppose there's a lot of press as well about the acting industry. Mm. But I suppose it was just the good people that Daniel has met and worked with and been lucky enough to come into contact with in the last 3 years. And in particular, he's just lucky recently he got a chance to go for an audition with Collective Dublin Productions. There was a really, really good guy in there, Greg. And he put him forward for an audition with David Keenan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you've had him on your show.
We have, the musician.
Yes. And so Daniel played young David in his latest video. So Daniel is, he's here beside me, but he is just blown away by the kindness of the people that he's met. Now, unfortunately, Daniel lost his dad 3 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
We're not terribly religious people, but he really kind of believes that these people have come into his life sent from his dad, or there's some sign there.
And remind us, how old is Daniel?
So Daniel's 13 now.
13. And can I ask you how your partner died?
He had an illness called HLH. So it was very, very quick. It was a virus, and it was just a very quick illness.
How old was he when he died?
43.
Well, that's terribly young. Okay. And that's difficult for all of you. And yet Daniel is shining like a star that he is and wants to be an
incredible
actor now.
Yeah, and he's here beside me, so I'm talking about him. But when his dad passed away, Daniel really gave up everything. So he would have been involved in rugby and playing the guitar and soccer, etc. But he didn't want to go to rugby anymore because his dad wasn't there with him. And he gave up soccer, he gave up his guitar. His dad had an amazing love of music, self-taught on the guitar and drums and things like that, but, loved all sorts of music. And I know he would have loved David Keenan, and he would have been blown away that Daniel has had this experience. But,
well, Daniel, at the age of 10, when something as enormous as that happens in a child's life, the light doesn't go out, it just fades. And in many respects, it needs to be reignited. And it looks like that's what's happened here.
Exactly. And he just out of the blue said to me one day, you know what, Mom, I think I want to try drama. And I was like, what? And so one of my good friends, a girl I used to go to school with, Mary, she was involved in drama. And Daniel had a drama teacher, Jennifer, in his school. And we just went up to a local drama class. And next of all, they put him into a FESH. And I went to see him in the FESH, never been to a FESH before. And, oh, my God, I suppose it's like you're in the Irish dancing world. You get a bit blown away by it. You walk into a room full of people and, full of adults and children. And he got up in front of this room full of people. And I ended up crying watching him. Because he totally blew me away. His drama teacher came along and she was like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot you've never seen that side of him. And he blew me away, and he got highly commended at his very first FESH.
Wow.
And then he's gone on, he's with Brennan Performing Arts in Leixlip, and they have an agency. And they put him forward for various different things. So in the summer, he was lucky enough to be in Godo. He was in Waiting for Godo.
Right.
So Patrick Sutton, he's been off the scene for a while. And so he was his comeback play, really. And Daniel was lucky enough to get a role in that. So he was doing that for 3 weeks. And there's two shows on a Saturday. And he's just a grafter. Anyone that he gets the chance to work with. It's a tough industry, and especially for a kid, and they're going off for these auditions, and my heart goes out to them all, and I'm sitting in the room waiting to see them all go in.
Yeah.
But he gets a break, and I'm blown away by the things that people actually say about him then.
You're not proud of him by any chance, are you, Joanne? I'm just getting a small sense that you're glowing. I can see it off the phone.
In so many ways. If I could get him to do his schoolwork as much as...
Put him on to me. Let's chat to the star of the show, Daniel Shields, 13 years old.
Hi, Ryan.
Daniel, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. I'm delighted to talk to you this morning. And you got cast as young David Keane in it for his new video for the Healing. What happened on the shoot that you found was so nice or so decent of everyone?
You know, I can't even explain it. There was just this vibe going around in the air, and everybody just had that general, like, really nice respect, and everybody was just looking after each other. And it was just like a great working environment. And it was just a magical experience.
And the postman delivered a little present for you, did he?
He did, yeah. It was so lovely. I was visiting my nana, and I came home from school, and I was wrecked after the day of school and stuff like that. And I came home and there was a package on my bed. I opened it up and it was from David. And then it was from Catalonia in Spain. It was a leather-bound papyrus notebook. And it was just such a lovely gift. I've been writing in it for the past 3 days. And it's just so cool knowing that David sent me. But that's how he wrote all his music and all his ideas, in those type of notebooks. And to have one for myself, it's just amazing.
Well, you know, Daniel, people like David Keenan are known in the business as good eggs.
Yeah.
He's a good egg.
He is.
That's for sure.
Such a lovely person.
Can I ask you a personal question about when your dad died? Do you mind?
I don't mind at all.
Just a quick question. When he died, your mum said that you gave up all the things that you loved, music and rugby and that kind of thing. Can you tell me why?
Well, he would always bring me to rugby, and it was like just kind of like a father-son thing. And like even after matches, we'd always hang around the rugby club to watch the other matches. And it just didn't feel the same just going without him, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, of course I do. And in those few years between, you're 13 now, but between, say, 10, 11, 12, did you find you just didn't have the love for the things that used to excite you?
Yes, I couldn't really pull myself onto it. My dad, he gave me the confidence to go and do the rugby. He told me to do guitar. He got me involved in it. So it was just kind of weird not having him there.
He was a good man.
Yeah. And then, I don't know where I'd be. He died when I was in fourth class. I went into fifth class, and my teacher was Anthony O'Flynn. I think you've had him on the show a few times.
We have. He's a super teacher. Go on, tell me.
Yeah. So he in St. Joseph's, he was my fifth class teacher.
Go on.
And he kind of grew my love for drama, because every year he would do plays and stuff in class. And the play we did was called Judge Not, and it was about a trial. And I ended up playing a woman, Victoria Waitrose, in the Karen Your dramas competition of all the schools doing dramas.
Yeah.
And it was just so nice. And that was like my first real play. And shortly after that, I was cast in Oliver and the Sean O'Casey Theatre. Mm-hmm. Connor Santry Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. And then after that, I went with him again, and I done more plays like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
The best. What were you in that?
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah. I was Mike.
Mike TV, good man. Okay.
Yeah, Mike TV.
And the witches?
The witches. I was one of the bad witches. They didn't really have a name. It was more like a background
character. I understand. And what happened, Daniel? You went from rugby, music and so on. What do you think happened that said, for you in your head, this I can do? You kind of reawakened your interest in life and the world.
To be honest, Ryan, I'm not too sure. I just came up to my mom one morning and I was like, I'd like to try drama. Because my dad loved, really old movies. He was a big Clint Eastwood fan and all. And I think it's probably something to do with his love of movies and stuff. I don't know. It's his love of movies, I'd really say, that kind of gave me the confidence to go to my mom and say, can I try drama? And I don't really know what drove me to do it, but I did it and I just fell in love with it immediately.
The fact that you were filming for the video for David Keenan that we've been talking about, and the fact that he took this almost, you know, paternal role, he just minded you and took you under his wing. And he's only a young fella himself, to me anyway. He's only 10 years older than you. But there is kindness out there. Do you find people are kind to you in a meaningful way, Daniel?
Yeah, he was such a nice person. everybody there was so nice. Like, if you ask somebody any question, they like to turn around and say it in the nicest way possible. And his mom and dad, they were such lovely people. Like, every single second, they were so nice. His mom, I can remember his mom asking me, what do you like in your tea? Do you like it milky or do you like it hard? And as soon as I was about to answer, he's like, milky, yeah, I knew that. It was just...
These are the funny things you tell. So you think of the wonderful teacher, Anthony O'Flynn, another great role model, and David being a role model. And then your mother sounds to me as, I don't know if you heard her talking beside you in the car there, she sounds like she's the proudest mother in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, she's really helped me. She's just wonderful. She's blushing here beside me, Ron. I think she might have a little crush on you.
I know. Hang on a second. Now, just a minute, Daniel. She's blushing because you're saying all these beautiful things about her.
I don't know. I think it's you, Ryan.
I need you to tell me about what is it about your mum that's so amazing?
I mean, I wouldn't be able to do these things if she wasn't there. She's just... Like, even if I need help with lines and the main thing, she just drives me everywhere I need to go.
She's your chauffeur.
She's my chauffeur, yeah.
You might as well get used to it if you're going to hit the big time, you know. Hey, listen, yeah. I know you've got to go to school, Daniel, but thanks a million for saying hello, because as they say in Toy Story, you've got a friend in me now as well, if that's okay with you.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you.
I want to give a massive shout out to Greg Purcell from Collective Dublin Productions.
Sure.
He was the team behind the video, and Brennan Performing Arts in Leakslip.
Great.
They have an agency, and I've met so many nice people. It was just, they're such lovely people. Can I tell you one thing about Gatto?
Yeah, sure.
So the cast, they came out in full uniform to the back of the theatre, where there's actually a bench in remembrance of my dad.
No.
And they got a good picture there, and it's just all the cast in, like, all the costumes, and it's just amazing. Like, people, they were so nice to me. It was Donald Courtney, Rex Ryan, Patrick Hughes, and Jared Byrne. They were just such lovely people. It was Patrick Sutton's comeback play.
Well, I mean, that's again just good people around you and everything. Well, Daniel, we're gonna talk again, I've no doubt about it, and I'm sure our paths will cross soon. You better put me back onto your blushing mammy for one second, and hey, good luck in school, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks very much,
mind
Ryan.
Yourself, you're brilliant.
We'll see you on the show someday, Ryan.
Yes, that's more like it. Fight and talk. I'll say a quick hello to your mum again.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. See you, Daniel, bye. Joanne?
The mum is blushing now. You don't have secrets with kids, do you?
You certainly do not. They are unfiltered. That's why we love them so much. Hey, listen, I just wanted to say to you, you have so much to be proud of. He's a gorgeous kid. And, you know, I think the future is so bright for you all.
Oh, please God. Yeah. Please God. He deserves it. He's a great kid. He's gone through an awful lot and he is just amazing. He's turned it full circle. Yeah. So I am very proud. I have a little girl, Isabel, as well. So she's an amazing little girl.
How old is she?
She's 9.
Well, tell her we all love her equally.
Oh, you would love her. She's a little dope.
Well, I've no doubt I'm going to meet you all soon. You.
Please God, please God. The next time I see you in Dundrum, I'll definitely say hello.
I'd like that very much. Joanne, listen, mind yourself and thank you so much.
I'll be the one blushing.
Yeah. I see the red-faced lady heading into a shop trying to avoid me.
Right.
Listen, good luck to you and everyone. Thanks, Joanne. Mind yourself. See you soon. See you in Dundrum.
And you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye for now. What a lovely, lovely phone call with Joanne there and obviously Daniel Shields. And just a little insight. You just don't know who the kid in the class beside you and what they're going through, and the brilliant teacher spotting the potential, and good people making music videos and not realising that not just any old kid. They've got stories. They've got stories to tell and hearts to mind. The text number 51551.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Nobody puts Muller in the corner. Yeah. Brian, good morning. Brian Redman, good morning.
How are you?
Yeah, very good. It's all change. I mean, it's very confusing. You're on Saturday, you're not Sunday. What's happening?
Oh, yeah, the whole thing has changed. Switch up week for Dancing with the Stars, yeah. Which I know you're always a little bit, about, but it's an interesting take this year. I'm just glad they've switched it to Saturday, not Sunday, because I had this awful fear that they might confuse the votings and, getting a result whereby, you know, Brian Dowling ended up as Taoiseach and somebody like Karen Byrne was tarnished or something like that. It could have fundamentally changed the country, do you know what I mean? You know, even after things like the Angelus, we could have had the Dancing with the Stars theme tune playing rather than the bongs for 60 seconds.
It's 6 o'clock.
Shimmying on the spot rather than, you know, moments of reflection. So I'm glad we've switched to Saturday night. Just 6:35.
6:35 on Saturday night. Do not confuse your votes when this all happens. We'll be talking to Brian Dowling and Kai Witherington tonight because they're doing... What are they dancing tonight?
They are dancing a quick step, I believe, tomorrow night.
Okay, and why is that significant?
Well, because it's the first time in Ireland, that we've had a same-sex couple dancing together, and we've two same-sex couples tomorrow night because we've got Lottie Ryan dancing with Emily. I know people have sort of, you know, been a little bit Irish about it. Say, oh, somebody did it in Denmark. And it was done in Denmark once, but it's never been done in Ireland or the UK before. You know, two of the pro dancers on Strictly last year did one number, but that was one of the guest sort of spots. It wasn't as part of the main competition.
But in these islands, this is a historic first.
For me, it sort of feels like the first dance at the marriage referendum party that happened a couple of years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes
sense. It's sort of a full circle, end of the night celebration of the thing that happened a few years ago. So I think it's quite significant, and I think it'll be interesting as well.
And actually, as Brian you'll be hearing later on the Late Late Show, his own personal narrative reflects that of the countries in terms of him coming out and acceptability and getting married as he did and so on. So we'll get into all of that later on. Father Ray is still hanging in there. There you are.
And because there's no elimination tomorrow night with being switch up week, it means we'll have the benefit of his grace for the next couple of weeks at least.
Grace before and after meals. And obviously Aidan Fogarty is flying along.
Yeah, there's a lot of them doing very, very well. I mean, you know, you've got a lot of switch-ups. Switch-up always presents a challenge, and particularly this week because we're switch-up with a day short. So because of the move from Sunday to Saturday, they have a day less prep time compared to normal. So they're going to be under a bit of pressure tomorrow night, and that should make for some great TV.